Radio Australia, on air and online at radioaustralia.net.au.
Time for our tech segment with Maurice Misiolaski, Business Futurist. You can find him at businessfuturist.com. Maurice, how are you?
Very, very good, thank you.
That's terrific to hear. There's plenty of news around tech-wise. Did you just hear about Encyclopedia Britannica?
No, I missed it. Fill me in.
It's called Time on its book sets. It says it's not printing any more of those. The last one that was printed was going to be 2010. That's already gone. That means they're not printing any more. And, I mean, they've been publishing since 1768.
Yeah.
That's a very long time. It's more than 200 years of print, and almost every household had one. If you wanted to say that had a family and you wanted everybody to be smart and learn about the world, that's not going to be a thing of the past. Of course, you know, we've got Wikipedia now, and there's all sorts of information that you could find online, but people were still saying, well, Encyclopedia Britannica, you knew that information was correct, that was reliable, but they're saying, well, you know, the time's up. And you saw this coming, didn't you?
Yeah, we did. We've talked about this for about 10 years or so, and even Encyclopedia Britannica has known that the writing was on the wall. They went to a different subscription model. They've tried online. They tried party selling of the encyclopedias as well. And nothing really bought in the volume that it needed because, as you said, the books were enormous. The print costs alone and the shipping costs were astronomical, and they really needed that huge volume of sales. It kind of is. I mean, nowadays looking at it, it's not a very, you know, it's not a very difficult story to tell, but it's kind of where we're headed. The reality is that we don't want a book that's fixed in time because, as good as Encyclopedia Britannica was, and I used to use it, it was my base reference when I went to school, and you used to wait every year for that volume to come out because there was an annual volume, and that was always the most up-to-date information. But now we know it was, in fact, 2 or 3 years old often by the time you got it because by the time they curated it, by the time they got it, put it into the volume and sent it to you, it was 2 or 3 years old. But yet it was the foundation of information that we had. And nowadays you and I are used to instant-on information.
Well, they say they're still going to exist in a data online.
In an online basis.
In some kind of, you probably pay a subscription or something, but they say that, you know, there are so many more advantages. They can update things in 2 minutes, information that needs to be updated. And, yeah, you do save on a lot of costs. I mean, gone are the days where you used to get a knock on your door or your doorbell ringing and there's somebody trying to sell you the encyclopedia set.
And they were great salesmen too. The other thing that's changed nowadays is we also, unfortunately, and I think it is unfortunate, we don't like to read as much as we did before, and especially students. Now, I can't argue the benefit of that because I don't see it. I mean, I would still love students to be able to read and engage with text. But the reality is that they want very short, sharp information. They want to see a video, for instance. They want a blog, or they want to talk to other people who are talking about the same topic.
If you have a message for me, it has to be able to fit into Twitter, which is 140 characters.
So as much as we might not like that, it is the reality moving forward. It's the world we've created and the world that they've accepted. And Encyclopedia Britannica, as good as it is, and it's a great publication, just doesn't fit into that genre anymore of students moving forward for their research.
Any fears for education in the future? I mean, if people are reading less and everything that's more concise, which means you don't get as much background information, you only get one side of the story instead of two or three, for example.
I don't, because you know, I always look on the positive side. I actually think education's moving in the appropriate direction for what our students will need it to be tomorrow. The reality for them is that they are going to be drowning in information. Encyclopedia Britannica is actually a great point because you and I, or I should say me, at school had Encyclopedia Britannica and World Book, and they were the two authorities, and then you went to individual texts in the library. That was all that we had, and there wasn't really a lot of contradiction between any of those articles. Nowadays, they're inundated from articles from everybody and everywhere. Some are so-called experts. Some are people who just have an opinion about it. Other people really don't even know what they're talking about, but yet form an opinion and put that out online. Tomorrow, students really have to be able to discern all of that and work their way through it. They also have to work in a very collaborative sense for the careers that they're going into, meaning that in my day, again, it was very much seen as a solo career. You went into a career, you were the accountant or the engineer or the bus driver or whatever it was you went, and that was pretty much what you did. You didn't need to learn a lot along the way once you had the qualification or the skill set. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
Not true for students now. We've talked before. The reality for them is that there are 6 careers and 14 jobs ahead of them. They'll live to 120. They'll need to be able to constantly mine information and be able to make good sense out of it.
You'd be very tired by the time you retire.
Well, yes, absolutely. And the notion of retirement is actually something that will change as well, because we won't retire on like we have historically, which is on a fixed date, let's say it's 64 or 65,
yes,
and then pension ourselves off. It's likely that we'll work in very different styles. But they will constantly need information and be able to work through that material. So we've really got to provide a way for that to happen. And this content seems to be the way for them to achieve that. In other words, really come in contact with a lot of information, work through it quickly, find out what they think is important. I'm not saying it is, but what they think is important, and then make decisions on the fly with that.
Information, getting it anywhere, anytime now is so important that you've seen this particular story about how one particular area, I think this is in the United States, is it? Where they've managed to turn homeless people into mobile Wi-Fi hotspots.
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting story. It's almost an odd spot story. I don't have a firm opinion on whether it's good or bad, and I was interested to see whether you think it is. So this is happening at the moment. This is happening in a program called Southeast Southwest, which is an annual program of geeks, boffins, and other things around the world. It's where you get to hear what might be ahead for the next year or two. What one of the marketing companies did was they went out and found homeless people through homeless shelters, and they provided them with a MiFi, which is a very upmarket Wi-Fi system. In other words, on the street, if you have a MiFi, you can use 4G and you can access the world. They gave it to them and they said, for the purposes of this conference, would you carry them around your backpacks? There's no signage, there's nothing, just carry them around your backpacks. Remember, geeks and boffins can smell Wi-Fi. We've all got dongles and all sorts of apps and things that will tell us where the Wi-Fi is. So no need to go out and shout it. And then if somebody comes up to you and wants to use the Wi-Fi, you charge them. Charge them whatever you think is appropriate. More importantly, let them pay you what they think is appropriate. And you can make some money out of this. Now, the marketing company wanted nothing. They're not a cent are they making out of it. Every cent that's earned goes back to the homeless person for mm-hmm. them to do what they want with.
And they were wearing T-shirts, weren't they?
Well, they could or they couldn't. They didn't have to if they didn't want to. Right. So there was, and on the T-shirt, there is no marketing as such. It just says MiFi. So there's no particular branding on this. They were not buying people as billboards.
Right.
If they chose to wear the T-shirt, it was neutral. Just announced that they were this MiFi spot. But that wasn't obligatory at all. So there's been, as you can imagine, the two camps. One who says this is absolutely terrible and the end of the world, and how dare you abuse and use people that really can't, the disenfranchised for this purpose. And the other one says that's a really interesting way for people that are not necessarily able to get a job immediately to make some money.
I can't see any evil intent out of this, to be honest. I mean, the company is not even, you know, getting any money back out of it, if anything. It's had to, on its own time, on its own cost, searched out these people in homeless centres, provide them with the equipment, print those T-shirts and give it to them. It's been at their cost. So the intention, I think, has been a good one, where people are debating whether, you know, they've been victimised. Personally, I don't actually see that, because it's helping. To me, I'm not sure the homeless are complaining at all. It's a way of making money.
Yeah, well, they're not. First of all, they were guaranteed a minimum of $50 a day, regardless of whether it was ever used or not. The going rate in Texas, where they are, is $7.25 an hour. So they were going to make more money per day than they might have had they had a job, and obviously they don't. So firstly, they were not being abused for money purposes. As you've said, absolutely, and there's been no contradiction of this. All of the money, every cent of it goes to them. So there's no payment of any kind. And I assume not that they'll be able to do anything with the MiFi, but, you know, all that and the T-shirts and whatever else would be theirs as well. What's interesting is they were equating it to a scheme which runs in Australia and elsewhere around the world, where homeless or disenfranchised people are able to sell newspapers on a 50-50 basis. So the way that they gain employment is they'll go and buy a newspaper at half price, 50%, I should say, that's purpose designed for this, and then they'll go out in the streets and sell it, and they'll keep the other 50% of the profit for themselves. So really the question is there any difference between that and this? And I come out on the side that perhaps there isn't. As long as there isn't marketing intent, as long as there isn't abuse, and as long as people aren't deriding the homeless people, I think, in fact, it's a nice positive way for them to get back into the community. And this same marketing company actually came up with a very interesting scheme a couple of months ago, which they ran in New York, again for homeless people. And in this case, they gave them prepaid cell phones and Twitter accounts, and they asked them to talk about their daily activities. In other words, expose the rest of the world about what it was like to be homeless, where they were, what was happening to them, their fears, their tragedies, their innovations, the things that they were doing, and just generally tweet about that. And that was a really interesting insight for many of us to get that one-on-one exposure of what it was like to be out on the streets.
I only see good things with that, I think, and I hope that provides some sort of insight into what actually happens when you do live on the streets. And, you know, it's easy to, I guess, compartmentalize people who are on the streets And because there are so many of them, it's easy to say, well, you know, I can't deal with all of you. If I give, you know, for something to one of you, everyone else is going to want something. Then where does it stop? So there are all those other questions at play, I think, in many people's minds. So it's always a good thing, I think, when you can step into someone else's shoes.
I think so too. And the reason I brought it up today for the discussion is really it's one of those things about social media that allows us to connect with people that otherwise we might not be connected with. And in this case, also allows people that might not have a job to have some kind of an ability to earn some income, at least for a short while. So social media is not really always that evil stepsister, you know, that we make it out to be. There are some really good positive things that might come out of
it. It's a tool. It can go either way.
Absolutely. That's exactly it. And we've talked about that as well. You know, it is benign. In the hands of people, as you said, it can be used for either niceness or evilness.
2012 Digital Future in Focus Report. And this is where you found some key online trends. What would you say is the most important one?
So this is a ComScore 2012 report, as you've said. It's an annual one. So they look across the globe and they look at how people are using digital space. There are some interesting results out of it. And one of the ones that I like the most is something that I've talked about for the last few years, and that is that email is on the decline. So web-based email is in fact disappearing. What they found was that this year, ages 12 to 17, that there was a 31% drop in email usage. And between 18 and 24, there
because
was a 34%. Absolutely. In fact, if you ask any teenager how often they use email, they'll tell you the only time they ever use it is for work or for school. In other words, there's a statutory requirement. Somebody said, I have to. Otherwise, absolutely, they're in Facebook, they're tweeting, they're SMSing, they're talking on Skype, they're playing in their games. They still talk and chat more than we ever did, but they're not doing it through email. That, to them, is really like a dinosaur program. And that's why I've said I don't think email as a major force of communication will be around much past the end of this decade. I think even the next 2 or 3 years we'll see email disappearing as the major source of communication.
Wow.
And many people, if they think about it, especially those that are in social media, obviously, will begin to realise that, in fact, they are talking quite a bit in Facebook or they are talking quite a bit in LinkedIn or in Twitter or other spaces without really knowing that's what they're doing. And that's what I'm finding, that the people that think it may be a strange thing to say when they look at their own daily habits of communication, they've in fact shifted. They're SMSing more, they're Skyping more, they're doing all sorts of things, not just emailing.
Interesting. Although for a business, they might stick to email slightly longer just because these are records of communication and what's been decided.
Yes, although we're already seeing changes in that because what's happening in many of the large corporations, which is usually where we look for the trend because they're the first to be able to afford it and the first to need it, is that they are using what are called CRMs, which is really just contact management systems. They're computer systems that allow them to trap all of the communication going backwards and forwards. They're now able to look through the social networks, so they're able to keep the Twitters and the Facebooks and the other conversations that are being had in those statutory requirements that they might need. So we're already starting to see that some software will do that and let you talk in other spaces and still keep it on record for you as long as you want. So that's an interesting one. It also came up with social networks most engaging destination, in other words, the places people go to the most often. And number one is, what do you think?
Would it be Facebook?
I mean, was there any surprise? So Facebook was number one, and the average people spent on it per week was 7 hours and 5 minutes.
Per week. That's actually better than what I might have thought.
Me too. Now, remember that Facebook is one of those things. I always look at Facebook stats like that. And you need to recall that Facebook is a program that's often on people's desktops, even if not active. It's kind of like always there, just in case.
Well, that's true. So the fact that people are online on Facebook doesn't mean they're engaged.
Yeah, it doesn't mean they're sitting there with their fingers typing for 7 hours. It just means that it's on their screen.
Okay, what's the second most visited site?
Second one is not something that we use a lot in Australia. It's called, or even in Asia, it's called Tumblr. T-U-M-B-L-R.
I've heard of that. What is it?
It's a great program. It is more of a visual one. So it allows you to connect up with pictures and share that kind of information.
So like a Flickr.
Yes, very much. All in that same genre, all that same kind of activity. And that one gets 2.5 hours of contact every week.
And very briefly, what's the third one?
The third one is something we spoke about a couple of weeks ago. It was that Pinterest one.
Ah, yes.
The thing that's only been around for a year. It's astronomical. It doesn't matter how often you look at figures. They come up over and over again. Now, that takes up 1.3 hours of people's average week already in that space of 1 year. And they have hit 11 million subscribers.
It's actually quite interesting. I've been checking it out. And especially if you're looking for furniture
or ideas
on how you can organize things in your house. And you're always looking for gadgets, some sort of way to hack things. to find another use for something that you already have around your house. It's a great site for that.
So it's amazing. And that's come up almost three times faster than Twitter, which is underneath it, because Twitter is average of 25 minutes only.
Wow. Amazing. Thank you very much for telling us about these trends. Morris Bezalowski is a business futurist. You can find him at businessfuturist.com. Thank you very much.
A pleasure as always.
Radio Australia, on air and online at radioaustralia.net.au.